Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday. So let's dive right into our Week in Review. More fallout from the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. Labor Secretary Alex Acosta is out.
I submitted my resignation to the president effective 7 days from today.
And until this came up, there was never an ounce of problem with this very good man.
We will also tackle the use of facial recognition software by law enforcement.
This technology poses an unprecedented threat to our privacy and civil liberties.
There is no blanket sharing of data with any federal agency associated with law enforcement.
And tensions are growing between two prominent House Democrats.
Overwhelmingly, our caucus voted to protect the children. Our blue dogs, our moderates, and all the rest voted to protect the children. They did not.
Well, it's not true. I mean, it's just wrong.
Is that a personal beef or a sign of a growing rift in the party? With us to break it all down is our Week in Review panel. Renee Graham is an associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Hey, Renee, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
And Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Ed, welcome back to you.
Great to be back.
Hey, listeners, we've expanded our Week in Review segment because we want to hear from you. What are you thinking about the biggest stories of the week? Weigh in. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to dive right in. We're going to start with the big news of the day. U.S. Labor Secretary Alex Acosta has resigned in the wake of the Jeffrey Epstein arrest. The arrest happened on Saturday. Acosta was a federal prosecutor in Florida who agreed to Epstein's original plea deal in 2007, which has become quite controversial. Now, as of Wednesday, Acosta seemed to feel he had the president's support and would be staying on, although he did qualify that a little bit.
I serve at the pleasure of the president.
Well, this just in, the president became displeased. So, Renee, why is he out now?
You know, if you watch that press conference that Acosta had, all I kept thinking of was Brett Kavanaugh. And if you thought about that, Brett Kavanaugh was on Fox News before he gave his testimony in his confirmation hearing. He was very demure. He was very quiet. That doesn't play well for Donald Trump. Donald Trump wants a performance. And Acosta was very professorial. He was very studious. He was sort of giving this very detailed explanation, but it wasn't the kind of fire and emotion that the president generally likes. And I thought he did himself a disservice in terms of appealing to Donald Trump.
So, Ed, that implies that the president likes to put somebody out there and sort of have them audition to keep their job by giving a fiery performance. It does seem that there's a pattern there. Is that what happened here? And did Trump do the right thing by saying, no, you're out?
The president seems to see America as an audience and not a nation. He seems to watch all of American politics through a television screen. Everything is a performance to him. I agree with what Renee said, that he simply failed. I don't really think this is a question of ethics, though I would like to think it was. I think also you have to consider that Donald Trump is also in the universe of people around Epstein. And I think that it's not impossible that he could somehow be dragged into this in some way. And perhaps it was nicer to have a fall guy around for if this gets worse.
So I do want to come back a little bit later to the Donald Trump Acosta Epstein connections, but I want to get into the details of this for a minute first for the listeners. For years, Acosta has said that as the federal prosecutor in this case, he took the deal in 2007 because he wanted to make sure that Epstein served time.
The Palm Beach State Attorney's Office was ready to let Epstein walk free, no jail time, nothing. Prosecutors in my former office found this to be completely unacceptable. And they became involved. Our office became involved. Our prosecutors presented the ultimatum: plead guilty to more serious charges, charges that require jail time, registration, and restitution, or we'd roll the dice and bring a federal indictment.
Renee, what do you make of that defense?
Well, you know, I thought it was interesting because within hours, some of the other attorneys who worked on this said that's not the case. Acosta really tried to paint himself as the hero in this, sort of doing the best he could do, you know, to put Epstein behind bars. But, you know, you're talking about the charges that Jeffrey Epstein was facing, the fact that he did 13 months of what was essentially kind of a work release. You know, there's no way, it's an indefensible sentence. So, you know, Acosta was trying to put the best face on it, but the facts don't bear it out.
Okay, so two things. First, listeners, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Call in and join the conversation. Also, I do want to make it clear, I was being a little snarky at the top, but we don't actually know if Acosta chose to resign or if President Trump asked him to or forced him to. Now, Ed, Renee has tiptoed into this question of the plea deal itself. Earlier this week, we asked retired federal judge and WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner about the plea deal. Here's what she said.
It was a stunning deal. It's a stunning deal. It was a stunning deal when it was disclosed. It really is a stunning deal. And it's a deal of no prosecution. It's not a plea bargain on the federal side. It was a deal not to prosecute after they had actually drawn up pages and pages and pages of charges. So it was an extraordinary deal.
And, of course, as the federal prosecutor, Acosta could have filed charges regardless of a deal struck by the state. So, Ed, how do you think Epstein got away with so little punishment here?
It sounds like he was just a wealthy and powerful man, and we don't have equal justice in this country in cases like this. And also it sounds like that he had friends and lawyers simply wear out the desire of the prosecutors to hold him accountable, that this isn't just about who you know. It's do you have the resources to grind the system in a way that it's going to decide it's not worth trying to get justice from you? And people like him can do that.
Ed, what do you mean by wear out the desire?
Well, I mean, we have reports of the fact that the lawyers for Epstein were incredibly, you know, voluminous, what they produced, how often they went after him, making everything take longer. They can add extraordinary costs to a prosecution, and therefore that reduces the incentives of the prosecutors to keep going and going and going when someone without those resources would have a much quicker process. So justice denied takes many forms. One of them is people with resources can wear out the system.
Renee.
You know, when we talk about criminal justice reform, it's often in the idea of eradicating mass incarceration. This is the opposite side of that coin. This is someone who essentially got away with almost everything, you know, because of his privilege, because of his power, because of knowing all the right people in all the right places. You know, it came out yesterday that, you know, one of the things that Epstein had to agree to was to be a registered sex offender. Well, registered sex offenders have to check in with their local police department. In 8 years, he never did it once.
So there's an impunity that runs past just the deal itself.
Exactly.
Here. We do want to hear from you listeners at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So both of you have made reference to the powerful friends that Epstein had. He's known for that kind of network of connections. Let's listen to what President Trump said today about his own relationship with Epstein. I think we're having some technical difficulties, so let me just move on from there. He said that Epstein was not somebody that he respected. He threw him out. He said James Patterson, who's a famous member of Mar-a-Lago, made a statement yesterday pointing out that he'd thrown him out. But we also know that he said some other things in the past that aren't consistent with that. In 2002, he said to New York Magazine, quote, "I've known Jeff for 15 years. Terrific guy. He's a lot of fun to be with. It is even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side." Then the New York Times has reported some troubling things, including a 1992 party where the entire guest list consisted of 28 girls attending a, quote, calendar girl, unquote, competition with Trump and Epstein. And there was a 2016 lawsuit filed by a woman under the name Jane Doe that claimed in 1994, when she was 13, that she was raped by President Trump at Epstein's house. He wasn't president at the time of the rape. That lawsuit was dropped on November 4th, 2016. Ed, how dangerous is this emerging story for the president of the United States?
It's not dangerous at all. I hate saying that, but I mean, this, how could President Trump's reputation in this area be any worse than it already is? We're already at bottom. It's a question of what do we do about this? It's like guns. How many people have to get shot before you do something about the way guns are managed in this country? I don't know what's going to happen to President Trump. I can't even guess.
So Arlene from Salem is awesome and held on with us. So we're going to go back to her and try again. Hey, Arlene.
Hey.
Hey
good
there.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Yep.
I mean, we have a similar case, very similar to Epstein is R. Kelly as well. You know, and why didn't he get one of those sweetheart deals like Mr. Epstein did? And I'm not certainly justifying what Mr. R. Kelly has done, but you know, it just goes to show the differences, the double standards. It is just a very sad circumstances that our country is watching It's terrible. We're living this. It is absolutely horrific.
Thanks for that, Arlene. Renee, what do you think?
I don't really know that I would hold R. Kelly up as the best example of you know, a difference between Jeffrey Epstein. You know, R. Kelly has been accused of sexual misconduct for a quarter century. Yes, he had a trial. Yes, he was acquitted. And for a long time, his career just went along just fine. The biggest stars worked with him. He sold millions of records and sold out arenas. So, you know, the question becomes, do the rules apply to powerful men? And that's what Jeffrey Epstein and R. Kelly have in common. Both very powerful men. You know, yes, the chickens may be coming home to roost now, but they've gotten away with an awful lot for a very long time.
Listeners, do please keep calling in. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Charlie from Bedford is on the line. Charlie, what's on your mind?
I think that it ought to be worth mentioning that... this wasn't just a non-prosecution agreement to not prosecute Epstein. It was a non-prosecution agreement to not prosecute anybody else who may have been involved in a conspiracy or confederation involving the rape and assault of these children. Including potentially Alan Dershowitz.
Yeah, so perfect, Charlie. Let's pick up from there because this is something that I've been thinking about. What about the rest of Epstein's powerful friends? As Charlie from Bedford says, some of them kind of got blanket coverage in this immunity deal, but he's been connected to people like Bill Clinton, Alan Dershowitz, Kevin Spacey. Ed, you said the president, unfortunately, in your words, is not vulnerable here, but how about some of these other powerful men?
Perhaps. I do think that what Charlie brought up was important, that this was clearly a desire to make this whole issue go away at the time and have no one else be held accountable for this. I have a hard time imagining that these people will come back into the spotlight without something else happening. I'm not optimistic about that. What I really hope is that there's a change in the culture in the justice system from end to end, from the people who do the, you know, the prison arrangements, the people who do the indicting, that we see more justice. We can't be a society that says that our own DA shouldn't be letting people off, not go to jail for minor things while rich and powerful people get sweet deals. I think we have to reconcile those and say, things and say we need justice from end to end in the system, and I hope we see the change.
So staying on the subject of rich and powerful men, but shifting gears to a more local story. Earlier this week, there was some interesting developments in the case with Kevin Spacey down on the Cape, because the young person who accused him of sexual assault pleaded the fifth in his own criminal prosecution of Spacey. And that probably means that the case is likely going to be dismissed. That's what legal scholars seem to think. One of the questions that's come out of the Me Too movement is whether any of the increased attention to these types of stories lead to real, actual consequences for the powerful, kind of to your point earlier, Renee. So do you think the Me Too movement has actually helped people who are accused of assault or harassment hold their the people who have assaulted them accountable?
I think what the Me Too movement has done is empowered victims and survivors to tell their stories, you know, to feel like they don't have to live in silence. They can come forward and talk about what happened to them. What the movement itself can't do is completely dismantle these entrenched systems and institutions that protect men, especially powerful men. You know, that's not on Me Too. That's on all of us. You know, that's not on survivors to do. That's on everyone else to do. So when you have a system where someone like Jeffrey Epstein or Kevin Spacey or R. Kelly, you know, what happened in the Kevin Spacey case was, you know, the victim was put on trial. And that's been seen time and time again whenever you have a case of sexual misconduct. So, you know, that's not new. You have to break that down. That's part of what the Me Too movement is trying to do. But to do that's going to take a lot more effort from everyone.
So we're going to shift gears now to a different story, but one that is, I think, about people being concerned that some new system not become entrenched before there are things that we can do about it. And that's this question of facial recognition software, its use with the RMV and with other law enforcement agencies. Listeners, we want you to call in on
on this subject. How do you feel about facial recognition, the RMV, law enforcement using it? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So it turns out if you have a driver's license, you're part of this massive database that federal law enforcement regularly scans looking for potential matches. We talked about it on Radio Boston earlier this week after a Washington Post report revealed that the FBI and ICE routinely search these databases across the country. So, Ed, first of all, what do you make of the revelation and, you know, that driver's licenses are being scanned, the pictures are in the databases by law enforcement? Are you okay with it?
Not really, but I believe this for many years. I've been a computer scientist most of my life. I know people that do machine learning, AI, and image classification, and the public has no idea what's possible now, and they haven't thought through the consequences of software being this intelligent and applied broadly. We have to really think about where are the firewalls in the system, how we want this to be used, and I think everyone should take a deep breath and think seriously about this.
So Governor Baker has weighed in on the issue, and let's hear what he had to say.
The only time the RMV responds to any sort of a request is a very particular and specific one that involves a federal inquiry. Usually it involves criminal activity. There is no blanket sharing of data with any federal agency associated with law enforcement.
Reassured, Renee?
You know, with all due respect to the governor, it always starts with there's no blanket acceptance of this. And then we find out later on, yeah, it was kind of blankety, but not as blankety as people think. I mean, you know, the bottom line is that we still live in this sort of world where we think that our privacy is our own. We think our faces are our own. We surrender all kinds of information through social media, but there's something really disturbing when you realize that the government is also doing this. One of the bigger issues I have with facial recognition is, and this came out of the MIT Media Lab a year or so ago, is that its inaccuracy. You know, if you're a white male, the error rate is about 1%. If you are a black or a brown female, the error rate is about 35%.
Yeah, we've got clip on this. So Cade Crawford of the ACLU of Massachusetts talked about this report when she was on earlier this week. Let's listen.
There have been studies, including studies here in Cambridge at MIT, that have found that the algorithms that animate these technologies actually have racial bias embedded in them. So, for example, some of these algorithms sold by even prominent technology companies have error rates up to 35% when they're examining the faces of black women. Whereas with white men, the technology works about 99% of the time.
Okay, so Ed, first, what do you think about a company selling something with a 35% error rate when it comes to black women? And second, how do you feel about law enforcement using a technology with this much bias in it?
The system is full of biases. Software sometimes imports the biases we already have. I think a lot of this was accidental. I actually know how these algorithms work, the training data was bad. Most of this kind of machine learning is done by feeding computers millions and millions of something and having them sort of learn things. If your database is full of all white men, then you're going to get good at that and not good at anything else. So there's lots of reasons why bias creeps into AI. But I think it's more important that the public recognizes that we need to regulate how this software is used and be wise about it, being that software is now embedded in everything. We probably can't stop it even if we wanted to.
So let's take another call. We've got Nico on the line from Manchester. Nico, share your thoughts with us.
Hey, I want to say that I don't think that AI facial recognition technology should be used by the FBI and by police, at least right now, because I think that it's going to be an encroachment on civil liberties and an invasion of the Fourth Amendment, which protects citizens from unreasonable search and seizure. And AI technology just overrides that and doesn't really give a judge the ability of, like, hey, if you want to look into somebody, you have to get a warrant to do that. And AI technology and facial recognition just overrides that Fourth Amendment entirely and gets
Great.
Rid of the civil liberties.
Great, Nico, thanks. And actually, what I want to do is I want to pair your voice, Nico, with another voice that we have, which was Scott Hovsepian. He's the president of the Massachusetts Coalition of Police. He was speaking to Channel 5 about facial recognition software.
If one catastrophe could be saved, if one abducted child can be found quicker, one murder victim's suspect is identified quicker, and the person can be brought to justice, I don't see why that's a bad thing.
So we've got this tension, Renee, between civil liberties and, hey, we can protect people, keep them safe, and prosecute. How do we think about that tension?
I mean, there's always that tension between safety and privacy. You know, if you remember right after 9/11, you had that color-coded terrorism chart. You know, we want yellow or it was red. You know, fear is great to control people. You know, we need to do this to keep you safe. And in the meantime, your rights are being eroded. You know, and suddenly it's like, well, no, this is good for you. Well, maybe it's not good for us. And maybe we have a right to opt out of these things. You know, when people go to the RMV to get their license, no one is telling them how that's going to be used and in some cases used against them.
So I want to put together two more voices that we have on tape here. The first, Senator Cynthia Cream has introduced a bill that would put a short-term moratorium on the use of facial recognition software. Here's one of the arguments for why she wants to do that.
I have constituents who have said to me, I'm going to march in a march. I march in the Women's March. I don't even know if there's going to be drones taking pictures of me, and then that is going to be used in a way by a government agency.
So that's a moratorium until we can put legislation in place that would regulate appropriately. So let's hear Cade Crockford again of the Massachusetts ACLU talking about what we need in terms of regulatory standards.
Walking into the 21st century with clear eyes, understanding across the board what we're doing with these technologies, which government agencies should be authorized to use these systems, under what circumstances, subject to which types of legislative and judicial authorization on a case-by-case basis. And that's just not happening right now.
So, Ed, that's a big lift. Should law enforcement have to wait with this kind of moratorium that Senator Cream is proposing until we get to the standard that Cade Crockford was just talking about?
I think it's going to be hard to come up with these standards. But yes, I agree that law enforcement should be constrained and in more than one way. They should be constrained in how they can access this. They should be constrained in what tools they get to use. But it's more important that we kind of put firewalls in place. This isn't just about law enforcement. This technology is already being deployed widely. We're always on camera everywhere we go. When all these databases start getting united, it's going to compromise our ability to feel like we're free, independent people moving around the world. If I know that I'm being filmed everywhere and that there are these incredibly powerful programs that will suck in all this data from all these places and show everything I'm doing all the time, will begin to make me feel like I'm not a free citizen. And that's possible. And law enforcement is just the beginning of what we need to do to consider the consequences of all this.
Okay, so Renee, that's haunting. But before we take a quick break, let me just ask you, aren't we kind of already there?
You know, as a thought exercise not that long ago, I sort of counted the number of cameras from my office to my front door, and it was about a dozen cameras. Yes, Ed's right. You know, we're on cameras all the time, whether we know it or not. But I do think there's a difference between a security camera and the idea that the government is allowing the FBI to have access to this kind of information without our say-so.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try. 617-917-4717.
So we're going to turn now to our third topic, which is the growing tension between congressional Democrats this week, specifically between House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Listeners, if you want to jump in on this, please call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So this started with what was called, quote, the squad, end quote. They've been called that for a while now, for progressive freshman Democrats, including Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They voted against a House border aid bill. They were the only four Democrats to vote against the bill. Speaker Pelosi called the four out, not joining the rest of the party.
Overwhelmingly, our caucus voted to protect the children. Our blue dogs, our moderates, and all the rest voted to protect the children. They did not.
Okay, so Renee, first off, what do you make of the squad voting against the bill?
You know, I think they're voting their values. I think the bill was not what they wanted it to be, and I think that's what they voted for what felt right to them. You know, I do think it was inappropriate for Pelosi to call them out. She could have that conversation with them privately. But I don't have a problem with them voting against a bill they didn't believe in.
How about you, Ed? What did you think?
I think this is wonderful. I don't mean that in the partisan way. The House of Representatives is meant to represent the passions of the people and is meant to be a place of squabbling. And this squabbling sounds very productive. This isn't like squabbling under Speaker Ryan or Speaker Boehner, where, you know, Republicans are debating should America pay its bills and all of that. I think that this kind of squabbling is about what the Democratic Party stands for and what should happen in the House of Representatives, what's worth voting on. I think this is what was intended, and I am enjoying watching it.
So Representative Ocasio-Cortez pushed back, kind of suggesting that maybe there was something a little bit dangerous or inappropriate about this. Let's listen to her talking to CNN yesterday.
It's singling out four individuals. And knowing the media environment that we're operating in, knowing the amount of death threats that we get, knowing the amount of concentration of attention, I think it's just worth asking why.
And Renee, she had said as part of that larger interview that she felt that this was the speaker calling out four young women of color who were newly elected. Do you think race is a factor here specifically?
I don't at the moment. You know, I do think that Speaker Pelosi's tone was condescending. I do feel like it felt like she was scolding them in a way that is inappropriate. They are grown women. They are not children. But I, at this point, will say I don't think race had anything to do with what she felt. She's trying to keep the House Democrats in order the way she sees fit. But I do feel like there's another way for her to go about this.
All right. So the lines are full. Callers want to talk to us. We're going to go to Adrian from Arlington. Adrian, what's on your mind?
Hi, guys. So, you know, just to preface, I'm 25 years old. I'm pretty young. So I identify a lot with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I kind of like that the squad is doing what they think is right and not just falling in line. I think that too often it's just expected that everybody's going to fall in line. And I think that, you know, they're representatives. They represent the people. And as a Bostonian, Ayanna Pressley is my representative, and I'm glad that she, you know, took a stand. So
thanks for that, Adrian. Ed, it's a little bit like what you were saying. Hey, this is healthy. We're mixing it up. We're having some conflict. This is productive to debate. Is that right?
Sure. And, you know, I don't think people should have to fall in line. We've had many years of watching Republicans not fall in line. I don't see why the Democrats should have to fall in line either. I think that people, again, the founders intended the fact that the House of Representatives, people represent their individual districts. They didn't say, well, we're going to have a system where Republicans and Democrats are going to have two teams and they'll fall in line and fight each other over the aisle. They envisioned none of that. I think that if Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez thinks her constituents want this, then she should just do it and not worry about how she looks.
Okay, so Renee, to this fall in line question, as I've been watching this unfold, what I keep thinking about is Speaker John Boehner, the Republican speaker, and his dealings with the Tea Party as they emerged in his caucus. He initially dismissed them, but he was eventually replaced as speaker because, in part, his conflicts with them and because he couldn't get anything done. So is Pelosi at risk here?
You know, she might be. But, you know, it's worth remembering that when the Democrats took the House back last year, there was this push to get Pelosi out. These women stood behind her and they stood with her. So
all four of them did.
All four of them did. You know, even though there was some question of whether or not they would and how what they were saying during the campaign, they stood with Pelosi. I don't know that they're ready to break with Pelosi now. I do think there is a kind of frustration that's bubbling over because, I mean, they also, you know, they very much want an impeachment inquiry and Pelosi isn't there yet. So I think that's part of what's bubbling over in some of this. But, you know, we're in this uncommon time. And I think these women are fired up with a kind of why we can't wait sentiment, to quote Martin Luther King's line. You know, I don't want to tell Speaker Pelosi to be mindful of her tone, but I don't know that any generation has cornered the market on caring about, you know, the future of this nation.
All right, let's take another call. We've got Steve from Dorchester. Steve, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Well, I believe in what these four women are, at least the one that we're talking, AOC, has to say. But we have to remember that they're all new. They have to be careful themselves. Pelosi might have been condescending in their eyes. She might have just been saying, listen, this is how it works. We all get a voice. But you're last in line. Let's not forget what AOC did for a living 9 months ago. She's not an expert on anything yet. And I think we ought to treat it that way.
So thanks for that, Steve. So, Ed, what does experience look like in the squad as they get move along? And also, I guess I wonder, isn't part of their edge and their power the fact that they are new and younger and less experienced in Congress?
No, their power is because they are popular. They've got media attention. There are other people who are new in Congress who are getting no attention at all. Even people of color in Congress who are not getting much attention at all. They have the spotlight, which makes them seem more important than they are. There are many other representatives who are righteous, who represent their constituents. Their opinions are no less important in terms of how the House operates. But because these four women have captured national attention, that they have their finger on the pulse of the changes in the party, that they are getting more attention, perhaps they deserve it. But it does not mean that Speaker Pelosi should manage things differently, because she must take in consideration all the other districts in the country.
Okay, let's take one more call. Michael from Providence, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say that Nancy Pelosi is very smart and chooses her words very carefully. She knows what she's doing. She's an expert politician. And to posture herself sort of in opposition to the squad, these four representatives, it's a safe bar to show that she's not just catering towards the progressive left and she's staying towards the center, which is really important if we're going to maintain our majority in the House.
Thanks for that. Renee, how does the Democratic Party manage messaging to the middle of America as well as its emerging progressive, some people would argue, coasts, which may or may not be the right framing, but we hear it a lot?
Well, you know, I think it's worth remembering what happened last November in the elections. You know, people really did vote for change. There's a reason why the squad won. You know, and that's not necessarily what the establishment Democrats were expecting. Certainly weren't, they weren't expecting someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to beat, you know, a 20-year incumbent. Or Ayanna Pressley, the same thing with beating Mike Capuano. I think the party is going through some growing pains. It's trying to figure out what it needs to be. But at the end of the day, the agenda is the same. However they get there, it's to right this country and defeat Donald Trump. I don't think there's any question about that. And I think so long as the party stays focused on that, the infighting will sort itself out.
All right. So there has been a lot there. Thanks to everyone who chimed in. Before we let you two go, I do want to end with our hubbubs. Those are those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Renee, let's have you go first. What do you got?
Saturday is the 6th annual JP Porch Fest.
Oh, I love Porch Fest.
Porch Fest is the best. And for those who don't know, it's 150 acts, live music, live performances, everything from hip hop to folk to classical to rock. It is wonderful. And it's exactly what it says. People performing on porches, in driveways, you name it. What can be better on a summer day in Boston than live free music?
Almost nothing, as a matter of fact. Okay, Ed, what do you got for us?
Well, I noticed something this week didn't get much attention, which is that supposedly the pharmaceutical industry, a big industry in Massachusetts, is unhappy with the governor because he is proposing limits on what Medicaid or MassHealth here will pay for drugs. It's kind of a unique thing in the country to see a governor pushing to lower drug costs. But for me, it was significant, even though it didn't get much coverage, because it was kind of a Nixon goes to China moment. This is a man who is a healthcare insurance executive who knows everything about this industry. They have gone to his fundraisers, he's spoken at their conferences, and now he's trying to do the right thing in a way that the people who go to his Lee fundraisers are not liking. And I wonder whether or not that this is a sign of things to come with terms of compromise between business and politics. And what will our governor do with all of his popularity? I think the drug thing is really interesting to see how far that goes and whether that will affect other issues, climate, taxes, and things. So I think it was really, really rare and interesting, and I didn't think got enough attention this week.
All right, so after you go to Porch Fest and enjoy the music, you can think long and hard about the political and business implications of Ed's hubbub. For me, it was the groundbreaking on the new AAA ball field in Worcester this week, where the Paw Sox are eventually going to move and be the Woo Sox or something else. And I thought it was just interesting in that it's an exciting event and a wonderful turn of events for Worcester and a loss for Pawtucket, Rhode Island. And it just sets in relief how a move like this benefits one community, but another community loses both business, but also sort of tradition and a piece of their identity. And I think it's possible to be excited for Worcester and sad for Pawtucket and recognize the good and the bad in that. All right. Well, Renee Graham, associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor, thanks so much for
Great
being
to
with
be here.
Us.
Thank you.
Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer, thanks for your time and insight today.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, thanks for participating with us in our first expanded Week in Review. Stay with us. Coming up, where does your local library rank statewide? Our next guests are on a quest to find the answer, no matter where you live in Massachusetts. I love libraries, so I'm very excited about this next segment. Adam Zand and Greg Peverill-Conti are on a mission to visit, rate, and rank every public library in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The project is called Libraryland, and so far this year they've been to 96 libraries, bringing their total numbers of libraries visited to 196. They're going to join me now. Greg, how are you?
I'm doing really well. Thank you very much for having us, Tiziana.
Happy to have you. And Adam, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
All right. So 196 libraries. That is a lot of libraries to visit. Greg, would you say you guys are almost done? How many are there? How many do you have to go?
You know, it's a little unclear how many there are.
What? We don't know how many libraries
someone does.
In Massachusetts, you mean.
But yeah. We've seen some people say there's 350, one for each town, but some towns have branches. I've seen numbers as high as 480. I think it's probably around 450.
And what do you think, Adam? Do you agree with Greg on this elusive number of libraries?
So we have a Google map. We rely on all things Google. And when the map turns all orange, I'll know we're done.
Okay.
When we go to visit a library, we switch it from blue to orange.
So you'll know when you get there, basically.
Exactly.
Well, and listeners can see as well. On our website, we have the map, and they can see it.
So they can follow along with you, kind of like a Dora the Explorer map.
Yes.
Okay. Adam, why visit every single library in the state?
Well, it started out actually out of necessity and location. Greg lives in Natick. I live in Arlington. And when we were forming our PR agency, Sharp Orange, we looked at the map and said, hey, let's not meet each other's houses. Let's meet in the middle, which turned out to be Newton Free Library.
Ah, my library.
And it's a fabulous library. We were able to get a study room that day, and we were super productive in those 2 hours. We planned our website. We planned what kind of clients we wanted to go after. And when we were walking out, we said, hey, we should do this again. Maybe not here, but let's try some other libraries.
And so that's how we got started.
Okay, so how many libraries before you were like, oh, you know what? We should do all the libraries.
Yeah. You know, it was probably maybe a half dozen. We went from Newton to Wellesley to Waltham to Weston to Wayland, a lot of the W towns.
Yeah.
And we started noticing differences. You know, some meeting rooms were really nice. Some had really good parking. Some had, you know, we started noticing differences. And so we started kind of informally rating them.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe 10 in, we formalized the ratings and decided let's try to do the whole state. And we've also now gone beyond Massachusetts and are seeing libraries in other parts of the country.
Isn't that a little ambitious given that you have maybe 450 just to do in the Commonwealth?
Yes. I mean, there's 17,000 public libraries in the United States, approximately.
Yeah, we're going to need some partners if we're going to cover the country. But I think it really is. It can be a great way to see Massachusetts. We've gone to towns that we've sort of heard of a name, and sometimes we haven't even heard them. And you learn a lot about the communities by what kind of library they have and what kind of community events they have. And
what kind of people are coming in and out. I mean, they're as Adam says, they're a great way to see the state. They're a great way to see any community that you're not necessarily a part of, or to be a part of a community if that's where you live.
So you both just said a bunch of stuff that I want to talk to. One of the first ones that I'll pick out is what kind of people come in and out. So do you see lots of different kind of people? Let me ask two questions. One, do you see lots of different kind of people in a particular library? And then do you see lots of different kinds of people across the different libraries you go to?
Yeah, I mean, libraries are a reflection of their communities. And so you'll see people from that community. The thing that people often think is that when you go to libraries, you're going to see two groups of people,
mm-hmm.
Children and caregivers in the mornings and senior citizens in the afternoon and then students coming home from school. That's three groups.
That is.
Three groups.
It is three.
And I think that holds true often, but we've also seen libraries that attract lots of different audiences. Charlestown here in Boston, that branch, they're one of the few that their primary audience is millennials,
mm-hmm.
Who are coming to work and to study. But you do see a huge diversity of people across libraries and in libraries.
And Adam, does it depend on the time of day or the day of the week that you're at the library, who you're going to see there?
There's a little bit of that. I mean, as Greg mentioned, those sort of caregivers and kids early in the morning, something to do, preschool age. We've been to, you know, we don't spend a lot of time, but there's some pretty creative children's librarians who are coming up with all sorts of programming. But as the day goes along, I mean, we're kind of focused on what we're doing and where we have access. But we always like talking to the librarians. When we walk in, it's sort of the first thing we say, tell us about your library. And then we also, more utilitarian, do you have a study room we might be able to use? So I think Greg's right. I mean, hopefully the sort of myth or anybody who's saying that libraries are sort of fading away in the age of information or the age of Amazon and the internet, we're not feeling that. We're feeling they're really vibrant. And like I said, there's a lot of creative librarians who are coming up with programming and ways that go so far beyond books, DVDs, reading group, you know, the kind of things that we've sort of experienced in the past.
Greg, what's an example of the creative programming that librarians are doing that you've noticed in one of these 196 libraries you've visited?
You know, one that I saw that was really interesting was in Wilmington, where they had a month-long series on civil discourse. Actually, Bill Littlefield was one of their speakers. And it was
has been a host here at WBR Only a Game.
It was to try to get people together to talk about issues in a non-confrontational way. And I thought that was a really great program that, you know, the director came in, saw a need in the community, and designed a program around it. Libraries are doing a lot of that kind of thing.
So for people, Adam, who don't regularly go to the library, what are some of the amenities or services that libraries have that they might not have thought of, oh, hey, I can go to the library for that?
Yeah. The one thing we've seen a lot of is, I mentioned it briefly, Library of Things. And a town like Millis, the Library of Things basically means you can check out items beyond the DVDs, books, traditional. So we've seen everything from beautiful telescopes, you know, very high-end telescopes, to a carpet cleaning setup in Millis. So
the other day, we were out in Oxford, and they have a fiddle you can check out.
A fiddle?
I play the fiddle, so I asked to see it, and it was out of tune.
Oh, no.
So I helped try to tune it. It's a lovely little library in Oxford, and it's a cool addition to the Library of Things.
I think going back to what you can get when you show up, so just like we're producing content right here, a lot of innovative libraries are looking at content production, whether that's podcasting or some of the sort of digital manipulation and moving things from one format to another. There's a library in Easton, Mass. That has a great podcasting room.
Where people can go in and record podcasts.
Yep. Yes.
Yeah. And also we were in Tingsboro a couple weeks ago, and they have their community access TV station actually has a facility connected to the library and also connected to City Hall. It's a multi-use building. So, you know, it's just a question of asking the librarian, you know, what's available and seeking out that Library of Things, what's going on. And then thankfully, there's a lot of digital boards and calendars that libraries are putting up both on their website and as you walk in to find out what's going on today.
So such range and diversity and vibrance in the libraries. Why rank them? Why start rating and ranking them?
You know, because I just do that with a lot of things. But I think it's also helpful, you know, to be able to say, you know, we went to the library in Webster, and you know, Webster is not a wealthy community. It's you know, it was an industrial town. We went to their library, and it got a perfect score.
Is it your only perfect score?
It is the only perfect score.
Oh, Webster. Somebody in Webster just went, woo-ha!
Well, and I'll tell you, the guys, the designers, Odin Zello, they did an amazing job. And so I think it's great to be able to go in and say to a library, you're amazing. I mean, you're all amazing, but people should go to Webster and look at the Gladys Kelly Library. It is amazing.
Okay, so Adam, what gets a library up into that coveted top echelon of your rankings?
So we have the 11 criteria.
Tell us.
Yeah, so we mentioned a few of them. It's sort of our user experience. Different people will have different ways of judging their experience, but we show up, we want hopefully parking or access to transportation.
Wi-Fi?
Yeah, you would think Wi-Fi would sort of be always a five, but it sort of isn't. Some places have passwords that you have to enter. When Greg was in Philadelphia, he had to actually give his library card.
No, I couldn't because you had to have a Philadelphia library card.
He would have had to be a library patron of Philadelphia to get.
Crazy.
And then some of the things, friendliness when we walk in, how are we greeted? You know, what are people sort of...
What's the appropriate welcome to the library greeting? Like, how does that sound?
So this gets a little creepy, but we're starting to be recognized from this
restaurant. You're like restaurant critics now.
But we always go up and ask, you know, we always, if not introduce ourselves, ask, like, this is our 90th library of this year. Tell us about the library. And it gives us an opportunity to engage in conversations. And, you know, librarians that we've met are so friendly, are so proud of the place they work, are so proud of the communities they serve and what they offer, that given the opportunity to talk about it, they love it. And I love it. And Adam loves it. It's just inspiring.
I think, you know, the rating system's great, but I like the experience of when you look around, what are you seeing? Are there architectural elements? Is there natural light? Are there stained glass windows? Is there interesting art on the wall? We don't necessarily rank those, but I think it does add to our enjoyment of the library. And we're really interested in how different communities are able to support their libraries and what they've done in terms of either rebuilding or renovating or doing additions or just really keeping kind of a balance between old and new and everything that sort of means in Massachusetts.
So what about one of the libraries that unfortunately is ranked quite low? And what would happen in a library that it's going to be very low in your ranking?
It's interesting. We actually were in a library a few weeks ago, and we were meeting with the director, and she said, "How did we do?" And we said, "Well, you know, here's how you did." And she said, "You know, what could we improve?" And we asked, "You know, why are your bathroom doors locked? You have a key hanging there, so obviously it's not a security issue." And she said, "You know, it's just been like that all the time." So I hope that libraries will use these and say, we can make a change there. She actually said, I'm going to take this to the town and suggest, hey, I need more funds to do new things. It's often happened that we've gone to libraries more than once and on those second visits see things we missed the first time and raise the rating.
So the Institute of Museum and Library Services, which is an independent federal agency, it has said that funding dropped, of course, after the economy kind of bottomed out and has started to ramp back up. But interestingly, we see two things. One, attendance does not drop off at the same rate as funding. And when funding goes back up, attendance really, really climbs. That suggests that libraries are providing a pretty needed set of services. Is that the take from the two of you as well?
Absolutely.
Yep.
And we've heard from so many directors that their numbers, their circulation figures, their number of patrons, number of library cards are all going up. So despite news of libraries' demise, that's not what's actually happening out in our communities.
All right. Adam, what would you add to that?
Just that the towns that we're really impressed with are actually the ones that might not have a huge budget, and they've gotten really creative about how to engage with their audience to it just going back to that welcoming. I get the sense that these librarians are always asking their patrons, what can we do? What would you like to see in the library? How can we better serve you? So the money is important. Both Greg and I have we're sort of learning a little bit of how the funding happens. We've been to the legislative day at the State House, and we've talked to our state reps about fully funding libraries. That's the ideal. But we're seeing a lot of creativity and a lot of, hopefully, optimism on everybody's part that libraries are growing.
That is Adam Zand and Greg Peveril-Conti. They co-founded the PR firm Sharp Orange together, and they're on a mission to visit and rate every library in Massachusetts with their project Library Land. For more information and a link to the Library Land website, go to radioboston.org. Adam, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. This was great.
Greg, thanks for joining Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. It was awesome.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.